You're with Food for Faith interviewing Brother Guy Consolmagno, the Vatican astronomer, on his recent visit to New Zealand. This first of three interviews is held with the business community of the region in Christchurch.
Well, I've got coffee, so we're ready.
Great, we can top that up anytime. What's in it?
About 2 years ago, I had the opportunity to talk to the astronomy department at Brigham Young University in Utah, where the Mormons are. And they've got an excellent astronomy department, and they don't drink coffee. How is it possible? I do not know.
That's why you're here. We drink it. Well, welcome to Christchurch. It's great to have you here and that you are here as well. I'm curious about what someone like you with the astronomer in the Vatican, mm-hmm. with the base also in Arizona. What is it that's unique about our sky in New Zealand? You've been here a number of times. You were here, in 2016?
Right.
And again, so
clearly... And back in 1997 en route to Antarctica.
Right. Right. Yeah. So clearly New Zealanders are attracted to you. Mm-hmm. What's your attraction to us or to our sky?
I've known the sky since I was a little kid. I had a wonderful book written by a children's author, the guy who wrote the Curious George books, which I'm told nobody in New Zealand knows, H.A. Ray. And it taught me the constellations. And then the last chapter were all of these constellations you can only see from the Southern Hemisphere. Oh. So I was desperate to see that. when I went into the Peace Corps, I was on the equator. And so finally I could see stars. But the really cool ones were way in the horizon to the south. You could barely see them. And I looked in the book, and you know, the Magellanic Clouds should be up. Is that it? Is that all? In 1996, I came down here to go look for meteorites in Antarctica. Now, two things every astronomer knows. You wait till it's dark, and you look up. So I went to Antarctica when it never got dark, and I spent the entire time looking down. But we found 400 meteorites. But I realized maybe this is the chance when I can finally see those things I was talking about. I asked somebody, you know, staying in Christchurch, where would I go to get really dark skies? And I have no idea who said this to me. They said Lake Tekapo. They were absolutely right. I went out there, spent a week in a bed and breakfast. Everybody else was off fishing. I was sleeping during the day. And I saw the Southern Cross. The first night, something I had dreamt of since I was a little kid. But the Southern Cross looked wrong. And next to the Southern Cross, there's supposed to be two stars you guys call the pointers, mm-hmm. but they were on the wrong side. And then I realized it's because down here, this far south, the Southern Cross is circumpolar. It will be right side up when it's high and upside down when it's low, and you can still see it. And this was astonishing. And there's the Magellanic Clouds, so high and so brilliant that when you look at the Milky Way, back home, the Milky Way is just a streak of light in the sky, if you can see it. Here, you can recognize that the Milky Way is a disk that I am inside, because I can see those Magellanic Clouds, which are outside. And the brain suddenly goes a clunk. It's no longer a streak out there. It's a thing I'm inside, because there are some things that aren't part of it anymore. It is that ability to move from the, yeah, of course there are stars, yeah, of course there's a, to actually being immersed in a universe of things I had never heard of before. I wound up with, I brought a little small telescope with me, and you guys down here in the Southern Hemisphere have some of the most spectacular things to see in a small telescope. It's not fair. Of the 10 most spectacular things you can see in a small telescope, I think 5 of them can only be seen in the Southern Hemisphere. And in the South Island of New Zealand, you are farther south than any other piece of dry land on Earth where people speak English. Why would you not? You guys are closer to the South Pole than my home in Michigan is to the North Pole. you can go out and see all of these spectacular things high in the sky. Did I mention that I kind of like doing this stuff?
That's the sense that we're getting, and that you have from the time that you were very young. In one of your books, I think, The Mechanics of God, you talk about being a little boy, a 10-year-old, out at the family, we would call it the family batch, with your mother, mm-hmm. and playing cards with her, and suddenly having this breakthrough moment. Tell me if I get this wrong.
Yeah.
You're going to pick up the story. Go ahead.
It was a rainy summer afternoon. We were talking about being by the lake. And I hope you've had a chance to be near the water as a kid, or you have kids, you can have them near the water. But it was a rainy Sunday afternoon. We're playing cards. I'm 10 years old. It suddenly dawns on me, my mom is playing cards with me, and she's a grown-up, and I'm a kid. What's in it for her? She can win the game anytime she wants, right? And when you're a kid, most of the time you're a kid, but every now and then you have this little flash of grown-upness. And you get more and more of them as you grow up. So that, as a friend of mine who raised teenagers said, teenagers are not half as mature as adults. They are 100% as mature as adults half the time. Well, at 10, I was 100% as mature as an adult 5% of the time. But I had this insight. She's doing this because it's a way that she can spend time with me because she loves me. And if she just said, "Guy, I love you, I'm a 10-year-old boy," I'm going to go, "Oh, Mom!" But this says it. And I had that memory one day in the laboratory, in the meteorite lab at Castel Gandolfo, as I was plotting a bunch of data I had taken. You just take a... Science is not, I have a problem, I'll devise a hypothesis, I'll make an experiment. Science is, I have a new hammer, I'll break things until they break apart, and now I try to figure out what to make of it. So I had a new tool to collect data. I collected the data, now what does the data mean? You plot something against something else, and maybe you'll see. And there was a pattern. And there was a pattern I didn't expect. Now, there's only 3 people in the world who care about this pattern, but I'm one of them. And I just had that sense of what a great game that God is playing with me, just like my mom. He's God, I'm not. But this is God's way of telling me he loves me. And I can hear him laughing and chortling and say, "Isn't that cool? Nobody else has ever seen that before. You're the first one." Wait till I show you the next one.
Wow. I was moved when I read that. I moved again as you tell the story, because there you've taken a lot of people think of this distinction between religion and science. Mm-hmm. But what you've done in that story, you, an astronomer, one of the best, a Catholic astronomer, a man of faith in God and beauty and love. There are 5 of those key words you've brought together in one experience, not just a story, an experience.
If you're not loving the astronomy, why are you doing it? Astronomy is not going to make you rich. It's not going to make you famous. It's not going to make you powerful. It's not going to get you girls. Didn't work for me.
There's still time. You're in New Zealand.
But you do it because it's full of joy. And I can understand why the universe has to be logically put together for it to function. But there is nothing that said the universe had to also be beautiful.
Wow.
And yet it is. And a sunset is beautiful. The Maxwell's equations that explain why the sun has those colors when it sets are also beautiful.
So why is it that the Catholic Church was so much a part of science until just over 100 years ago, when the distinction between, or the tension between faith and science began? What happened?
I think, it's a Victorian thing. You're absolutely right. It did not start with Galileo or something like that. Catholic priests were doing science. In Castel Gandolfo, where we live, we moved out from the Rome to this summer home in Castel Gandolfo about 1930. The Vatican Library decided this was the time to clear up some shelves by getting rid of all their modern science books. For them, modern means printed with a printing press. So we've got, you know, the philosophical transactions going back to 1665. And you see, who's doing the science? Who is a scientist in 1820, in 1740? Either you're a wealthy nobleman, or maybe you're a medical doctor, or you're the Reverend so-and-so. Because in those days, who else has the education and the free time to go collecting leaves and whatever? What happens, though, at the end of the 19th century, science becomes professionalized. And there are a few threads going on. One of them is that the universities are no longer just church universities. You can pay money to go to somebody's private university. And they're going to say, oh, why should I pay money to you? Because I'm not going to give you that church stuff that the other guys. I can tell you the truth. Well, you know, the truth actually doesn't change. Another thing in America is, at the end of the 19th century, America was being flooded by terrible people with long names that ended in vowels, like Consolmagno. And we had to keep those terrible people out. And the other thing they had in common was that they were all Catholics. They came from Poland, they came from Ireland, they came from Italy. So a couple of prominent people wrote books about how these Catholics, who of course, you know, stopped Columbus from trying to prove the world was round. Columbus never even made it around the world, never mind. We've got to keep them out because they're anti-science. And they started, it was really an anti-immigrant thing. In Europe, it was a political thing. The unification of Italy was done over the objections of the Holy See, so the government was bitterly anti-church. And they invented reasons why they were better than the church. So they went a long way to invent the Giordano Bruno myth and the Galileo myth. There was one other thing going on at the end of the 19th century. We've got electricity and steam engines that are going to solve all of our problems. Science is clearly going to solve the things that religion could never do. And one of the big scientific trends that was going to solve all of humanity's problems was given the wonderfully Greek-based name eugenics. We're going to breed superior people. What are superior people? Superior people are people who look like me, clearly, not people that look like him. Heaven forbid. And the only organized group saying maybe there's something wrong with eugenics was the church. So people then concluded, well, the church must be anti-science. And sadly, the 20th century, we saw that, you know, Adolf Hitler had probably better electricity and better steam engines than Socrates. It didn't make him a better human being.
So now with the clarity of what you're saying, that there shouldn't be any tension between faith and science.
There's no reason for it.
Why is there still? What is it that's driving the separation? Why is it that, as far as I can see, the question that you're asked more often than any other question is, how can you be a priest and a scientist?
Right, or a brother and a scientist.
A brother and a scientist.
Part of me has to come up with the classic scientific answer, I don't know. I honestly don't know why people think there's a conflict, because I've never encountered it in my life. And when I was growing up, who taught me the science? The nuns in my grade school, the priests in my high school. One insight that I came up with was a bizarre conversation I had with actually William Shatner. You know, I just dropped a name there. Don't ask why I was having a conversation with William Shatner. It was a bizarre circumstance. But talking to him, I realized he thought that religion was a big book of facts and that science is a different big book of facts. And oh my gosh, what happens if the facts in one book don't agree with the facts in the other book? But science is only a big book of facts when you're 12 years old. And you're trying to get up to speed. You're trying to learn to play the piano by playing scales. Mm-hmm. But playing scales is not playing music. And religion is not a big book of facts. Religion is this lived experience. And both science and religion are totally incomplete because we never completely understand the universe. We never completely understand God. And the places where science disagrees with religion are the most exciting places. Because I can tell you, as a scientist, the real exciting place to do science is where this bit of science disagrees with that bit of science, and then you say, my gosh, there's something going on that I hadn't thought about before.
So science and religion need each other.
Not only do they need each other, they give each other tremendous power to find where they've been lacking. And a scientist who doesn't have a religion is missing out on half of the fun of being a scientist. And a religious person who doesn't have some background in science is missing out on one of the best ways of encountering God. So I don't know why people don't do this. It's so obvious to me.
Clearly you are someone who has encountered God. You are a Jesuit, mm-hmm. not because you are, it were, before then a scientist, but because you have encountered God in some way. Yeah. Given that there are three groups that you're with today, there's this Catholic business lunch here mm-hmm. now, and then this afternoon at 5 o'clock you are with 300 high school and university students, and then mm-hmm. tonight it's an open public gathering. So this is the gathering at which you can be most specifically Catholic and speak yeah. about faith. So what would you say that specifically about the way that your faith has grown and been nourished because of your work?
One of the things that happened when I was thinking of becoming a Jesuit was you do a retreat, you do interviews, you get letters of recommendation. The Jesuits don't take just anybody. Of the 100 people who apply, maybe 5 get admitted. And during one of my week-long silent retreats, in the dead of winter, I was just, you know, it's a bleak sort of blah kind of winter. And I'm thinking, we were out in the countryside, wouldn't it be beautiful if it snowed? And the next morning, there's snow on the ground. And I go to my spiritual director and I go, you know, I hate to think that it was my prayer that did that, but... And he gave me this marvelous phrase, divine coincidence. And hearing that word, I began to see divine coincidences in things that happen in my life where I just happen to be in the right place at the right time, where the right experiment happened to be done a year before I realized somebody else was going to need those results. That there is, I'm living in this universe that at the same time God is present, and yet God gives it freedom. God gives the universe freedom to evolve. And recognizing the omnipotence of God is not that God can do anything he wants, but that God is so omnipotent he doesn't have to. And he can actually, God wants to come and join the physical universe. He doesn't come down on a cloud of glory with lightning bolts everywhere. I'm God, you better listen to me. He comes as an infant in an obscure part of Galilee. And seeing the same personality of the Creator, that things are subtle and humorous and beautiful and logical, and then seeing that in my faith life and seeing that in the story of Jesus, and I'm thinking, I'm seeing the same author here.
I can't help but make the connection when you say that, that it was a star that led the first wise people to encounter Christ. Mm-hmm. What was the star, the Bethlehem star?
Beats me. People ask me all the time, I have no idea. There are a dozen books, there are 400 books if you come on Amazon, and they all have different answers. I wasn't there, I didn't have a video machine. It's completely conceivable that Matthew, writing up the story, was taking an old story about Abraham and converting it to say that, you know, or an old story about Augustus Caesar, who used the positions of stars to say that I'm somebody important. And he used this as a way of saying this Jesus was somebody important. It might have been a pious story. Or it might really have happened, because there are dozens of things it could have been. So let's twist the question around and say, why do you want to know? Why is it that so many people are writing books about what's the Star of Bethlehem? Why is it of all the gospel stories, the Star of Bethlehem is one that almost everybody knows? What is it about the power of that story that rings in the hearts of people, whether they're believers or not? And that people have a huge, if we can prove the Star of Bethlehem was real, then it shows the Bible was true. Well, you know, I hope you believe the Bible was true without knowing what the Star of Bethlehem was. If I can show that the Star of Bethlehem was just a supernova, then I can show that there was nothing supernatural about it, and therefore there's no God. You know, what? People try to read into what they expect to see. Oh. I love the story just because it's such a powerful story. And I love the games that people play about what the star might have been. Yeah. But I don't know. This is how you get people, you know, if you're ever doing a PhD defense and they ask you a question, you go, I don't know, and this is...
it's refreshing to hear you say I don't know, because so much of our faith is... Yeah. I don't know means I can't put this experience into words.
Which is also part of it, yeah. And a faith that doesn't have mystery is not a faith that's consistent with the rest of the universe. Mm. It can't possibly be true.
Indeed. I was interested last night, many of us saw the segment on right. Q&A, you in Tekapo, and it was interesting to see their astonishment that a Catholic and a Jesuit was interested in astronomy and saw no conflict with science.
Who do they think invented this stuff? Astronomy was invented in the medieval universities founded by the church.
You see, now I'm just distracted and thinking of another example you gave about we think of the Big Bang Theory. Mm-hmm. We're also invented
by a Catholic priest. He was not a Jesuit, I have to point out. It is possible to be smart and not be a Jesuit.
That's right.
Rare as that may be.
Well, when I was discerning priesthood, I had the option of being a Jesuit like Ignatius or a diocesan priest like Jesus. So I just chose it. But it was interesting that at the end of that Q&A segment, Jack Tame said this, I wrote it down, he said, there's a lot happening on our program. I don't know if you saw the full program, but there was politicians interviewed and all kinds of stuff going on. But in the little close down, which you never got a chance to respond to, he said, our program deals with everything, including defining the existential question for our species, is there life on other planets? The existential question of our species.
I'm glad he solved that one.
Wonderful. So I have met a number of people who I think may well be from other planets, but what do you think? Is there life on other planets?
I have to go back to the I don't know, but... I'll be more specific than that. I'm the director of an observatory now. Among the things I have to do is to parcel out the resources, who gets paid, who gets telescope time, who gets to go to meetings. If you were a scientist working for the observatory and you came to me and you said, I really want to study the possibility of extraterrestrial life and intelligent life, and here's a program that I want to do, here's the telescopes I want to use, I have to say, there is no evidence that this life exists, but there never will be evidence until we look for it. And I believe in the possibility strongly enough that I'll give you the resources to do it. If, on the other hand, you came and you said, I want to go to UFO conferences and talk to the people who have been transported by UFO people, then I go, I don't think so. Because I don't believe in UFOs. Now, I could be wrong. I could be wrong on both of those things. But here's how science works. Before you do the experiment, you have to have a hunch, you have to have faith that there is something there to be seen, and you have to have faith that we have the tools to be able to make some progress. You have to have that faith before you have the evidence. So science is faith-based.
I know that people here are familiar with your videos, a number of which you appear with Pope Francis. You appear like great mates with Pope Francis, and he with you too. Tell us about your experience of him. Like he's universally, apart from those who don't like him, people like him. So tell us about your experience of the man.
I won't claim to be really close friends to him. I don't know him that well. That said, he knows who I am, and that's by itself kind of scary. In 1990-something or so, there was a young man who was interested in joining the Jesuits, who was studying astronomy. His name was Jose Funes. And he interviewed with the Jesuits to see should I join or should I finish, you know, join now or should I finish my astronomy degree first. And of course, you get interviewed by an older Jesuit. And in his case, the older Jesuit said, stay, finish your studies. Astronomy is important to us. And Jose Funes became the director of the observatory. He was the director before me. And the Jesuit who interviewed him was Father Bergoglio, who became Pope Francis. So long before they were in any kind of positions, Francis understood the importance of astronomy. Francis is a Jesuit. Mm-hmm. The astonishing thing that I see in Francis, and I've you know gotten to know three popes a little bit. Again, I wouldn't claim to be close buddies with any of them, but I was able to see them behind the scenes. John Paul II, especially in his later years, was the most frighteningly impressive. He had an aura about him. As he got physically weaker, he became more and more powerful spiritually. And you would be in his presence, and you would know you were in the presence of somebody very spiritual, very close to God. Mm. Benedict, when you see him off stage, you know, when he gets in front of a group of people, he lectures at them like he's a German professor, because he is a German professor. But off stage, he's witty, he's intelligent, he asks great questions, he listens to your answers. He was just a delight to be around. And that was a side of him that I had never seen. So I was impressed by JP2, and I was, you know, I really like Benedict, mm-hmm. but I love Francis. Mm. And the thing I love about him is that, on the one hand, he has this enormous patience with people. He has patience with the human frailties of people. And he doesn't think that you have to be perfect before that you're good enough for him to pay attention to you. And there is this, you know, in him you see the love of God coming through to the people he's with. In addition to that, though, he's also a really good politician. And you don't have to be evil and Machiavellian to be a politician. One of the powerful things about him is that he doesn't care what you think of him. You can't manipulate him by saying, if you do this, you'll be popular. If you do that, you won't be popular. And, you know, when people attacked him, his answer was not to defend himself, but to say, check it out. Check out the attacks. And if I'm wrong, I'll change. But, you know, Benedict was one of the most brilliant people ever to be Pope. Mm. And he knew the reforms that needed to be done at the Vatican, and he didn't know how to get them done because his skills were in academia, they were not in politics. Francis, having grown up in, you know, the maelstrom of Argentina during all the revolutions, understood. You can be, I love science fiction. I go to science fiction conventions all the time. Science fiction and fantasy is great fun. And one of the program items we do is to talk about, Guy, what's it like living in an absolute monarchy, you know? It's the last place in the world where you've got the king who's got all the power, just like in Game of Thrones or whatever, without quite all the sex. And what you can see living in an honest-to-God absolute monarchy is, yeah, the Pope, in theory, has the power to fire you, to fire you, but you don't get anything done if you fire everybody. Things only happen if you can convince the people under you that they want them to happen. We've all worked in offices, I suspect, where your boss gave you something to do, you really didn't want to do it, you put it on that pile of stuff that you'll get to one of these days, and you hope that by the time you get to it, you've got a new boss and you don't have to do it. And that's the temptation when people are being asked to do things that make them uncomfortable. Reform the way that the finances are done. The old way worked. We kind of, you know, nobody understood it but us, but we understood it. And that's got it good enough. How do you convince people that you really want to be invested in a new way of doing things? How do you motivate them to want to do that? And he's figured that out. It's slow, but it's inevitable, and I don't think it's going to be reversed by, you know, whoever comes next, because it's too well along, and it's too illogical, and he's convinced too many people that, yeah, these things needed doing.
Yes.
And he can do that while being spiritual and loving, and he can do it without knocking heads together.
So speaking of the Pope, one of the great titles of the Pope is Pontifex, which yes. is bridge builder. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering how astronomy, science, can be a bridge builder in the world from the faith. There are examples I know where Pope Francis is building bridges, some many would say, but then there's a situation between the government of Iran and the Vatican.
Yeah.
the government a bridge of Iran, is being built using science.
Yeah, the government of Iran loves the Vatican City-State because they see it as the other theocracy in the world. And astronomy has been a place where we have been able to communicate together. A couple of years ago, scholars from Iran came to the Vatican and worked with us at the Vatican Observatory on a way of discussing the historical role of astronomy in religion. In 2009, there was the International Year of Astronomy. This was 400 years after Galileo and his telescope. Galileo was a great Catholic and a good Italian, and we're proud of him, and he wouldn't have been the first Catholic to get in trouble with the church. What you learned in 2009, one of the great phrases is, we all live under the same sky. And we can all appreciate the same things looking at the sky. One of the great things about astronomy is that you don't have to have a PhD to be able to look at the stars and go, oh, wow. You don't have to have a telescope. You can just use the naked eyes. You don't even have to be visual. We've got programs now for blind people to learn about the universe and learn what we've learned about this place where we're living. It is a common ground that we can still talk to each other. One of the things I had to do years ago, I was elected to be the president of the American Association of Planetary Scientists, the Division for Planetary Science of the American Astronomical Society. And it was my job to go to Washington, D.C. and talk to them because they're funding the Americans doing planetary science. Even though I don't get funded by them, I get funded by the Vatican, which is very convenient. One of the things I discovered is that the funding of space is one of the few things in the American government that's not divided Republicans versus Democrats. That there are people who love it in both parties and people who hate it in both parties, but it's not divided by party lines. Because the philosophy of exploration extends to everybody. There was this marvelous experiment, the gravitational wave experiment, LIGO. And I've got buddies who work on this. This is a new way of observing the universe by seeing very, very, very tiny fluctuations in the space-time continuum caused by black holes running into each other. And the money for this came from the U.S. government. Mm-hmm. So the guy who wanted the money, who had dreamt up the idea, and the head of the National Science Foundation are doing the rounds of different senators to see if they can get funded. And they're coming to this very conservative Republican, The guy from NSF is terrified. And the Republican is hearing this whole report, and he goes, so answer me one thing. Of what practical use is studying gravitational waves? And the NSF guy is about to come up with some cockamamie thing, how it's going to give us, Teflon, I don't know what. Before he can say anything, the scientist goes, absolutely not at all. It's pure knowledge. And the senator goes, well, if there's no practical use for it, there's no way private industry is going to pay for it, so I guess the government has to. And that's how they got their funding.
Now, unfortunately, we're just on time, but there is one more. I want you to give us a take home. I think every one of us has children, grandchildren, mm-hmm. nephews, nieces, yeah. godchildren. What's one take home, given that we've got the visual aid every night?
Yes.
Most nights. It's mm-hmm. So, what's a take home for children? Like, how can we communicate what you would like to see us communicate to children? I remember my grandfather on the farm just south of Waimate took me out and showed me the Southern Cross. And that was a beginning moment for me, somehow understanding this kind of, but what can we take home here in the South?
You have to spend time with the kids. I learned astronomy because my father, who'd been a navigator in B-17s during the war, learned astronomy and taught it to me. And it's a great time to tell your kids you love them by being with them, going outside, looking at the stars. Of course, that means you've got to know the stars. You've got to be able to know where the Southern Cross is. I love that H.A. Rey book. It's the one I recommend to everybody.
This is Curious George.
the guy who wrote Curious George also wrote a book called The Stars. And it's kind of a hard name to forget. But even if you don't want to go that far, get in the habit of every night going out and looking for the moon. And try to pay attention to where was the moon last night, where is it tonight? And can you see a pattern? I remember as a kid looking out my bedroom window and watching the moon set. And there's something magic about that. Of course, the moon is there, then it's not there. You don't want to watch the sunset, you hurt your eyes. But you can watch the moon set. And just to be aware of what is in the sky, it reminds you that the universe is bigger than what's for lunch. That there's all of that stuff out there. I grew up in Michigan on the shores of Lake Huron, and neighbors just to the north tell the wonderful story of they had the grandkids over. So there was a little three-year-old on Christmas, which of course is our wintertime, sun rises over Lake Huron, and it's marvelous to watch the sunrise. So grandma is there with the little three-year-old, and you see the colors, and you see the light, and you see the red ball coming up, and he's just enthralled. The next day, grandma's in the kitchen making breakfast, and she hears the shout from the front as the kid's looking through the window over the lake saying, "Grandma, come quick, it's doing it again!" We have to remember to capture that amazement that every day we have a sunrise and a sunset, and they're glorious, and they're for free.
Brother Guy Consolmagno, thank you.
Thanks. Thank you. All right.